In this part of Focus 580, we will be talking about identity, about this notion of what is it that makes one person different from another? And are there any differences that really matter? For a long time, when we talk about that very question, we talk about identity, people focus generally on physical characteristics, male and female, ethnicity, race, although there probably have always been people who questioned just how important those things were. But for a long time, those were the markers that distinguish one person from another. Then along comes genetics, and genetics tells us that if you look at people's DNA, that basically we're all the same. And some people said, well, that's what we thought all along. But it seems that these sorts of notions that there are fundamental physical differences between people and that allows us to break them up into groups are things that just won't go away. And in fact, genetic science still seems to be inclined to divide people up that way. Well, we're trying to talk about some of these issues this morning with a scholar who has thought a lot about it, has written on a variety of issues, both in English, of which he is a professor, also in disability studies, disability issues, and also in politics. His name is Leonard Davis. He's on the faculty at University of Illinois Chicago and is attached to both the departments of English, also disability and human development, and medical education. He's written widely on various subject literature. He wrote a book, for example, titled Factual Fictions, The Origins of the English Novel. He's also written about disability issues in books like Bending Over Backwards, Dismodernism, Disability, and Other Difficult Positions, another titled Enforcing Normalcy, Disability, Deafness, and the Body. He has also written about some of his experiences as the hearing child of deaf parents, and one book dealing with that is his memoir, My Sense of Silence. It was published in the year 2000. He's here visiting the campus. I gave a talk yesterday afternoon in the MillerCom series. We're pleased that he could be with us on the show. The number, if you'd like to participate in the conversation, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
To start, I guess, maybe we might talk about the tendency that we have had for a long time, I guess, to think about this issue of identity and look at, and think about it in terms of physical characteristics, physical markers. So as a way of saying this person is different from that person, you know, we look at body parts. You got a vagina, you got a penis. Well, okay, and there's some pretty obvious differences there. Other ethnic kind of markers, sometimes just what color a person is. And we have used that to divide people up into different ways. Mm. Is that just the easiest sort of thing to do, or is it that we're looking for obvious differences? And
well, I think that, you know, I backtrack a little bit what you're talking about and saying that, you know, I think over time, people have kind of naturally thought about differences among humans, among themselves. And, you know, one of the things, humans do two things. They look at each other and say, we're all humans. And they look at each other and say, oh, but you're from, you know, Nebraska and you're from, New York. And, so there is a tendency to find difference. So if you look in the past, I think what you'll see is that, you know, the Europeans, when they first came to the Americas, for example, saw the Native Americans as other peoples, as other nations, but they didn't see them as another race. And likewise, peoples in Africa, for example, didn't say about themselves, oh, we're of the race, of a certain race. They said, well, you're from Nigeria, I'm of this tribe, you're of that tribe. I mean, in other words, the tendency to think about difference is one that was kind of more general. And we reach a flashpoint in the middle of the 19th century, and that's when science kind of steps in. Mm-hmm. And humans decide that they're going to divide humans up in a very kind of categorical way. They're going to put a grid over human existence. And they're going to say, there are races, and these races are known by certain kinds of biometric characteristics. In other words, if we start measuring head size or arm length or any of the sort of physical features, or if we start measuring something very vague called intelligence, which we'll design a test for, and we'll come up with categories that we will invent, including the category, for example, of moron, which is an invented category in intelligence tests, that we'll be able to sort of scientifically tell you the number of races that there are and who belongs. And I think when people started doing that, that created a very different kind of way of dividing up humans. On the male-female one, I mean, you kind of gave what sort of like the Sandlot, you know, easy argument about male-female. But in fact, actually, it turns out if you look in the past, and there's a couple of scholars who've done this, Tom LaCour for one, his claim is that before kind of the middle of the 18th century, the distinctions between the genders were not that firm. I mean, that, in other words, we tend to think you're born with a penis or a vagina, and that kind of gives you the, you know, automatic assignment of what you are. But actually, in the earlier period, people believed that your gender could change. And in fact, they believed that, for example, that the vagina was simply a penis inside out. And that if you, like if a young girl jumped over a fence, that it might be possible. And there are certainly documented cases that they documented that vagina would kind of come out and become a penis. So even that notion that there's an absolute fixity is something that kind of has its own scientific rising and falling. And even now, we now are starting to recognize the real range of possibility there is along the gender continuum. Mm-hmm. For example, there are, you know, someone can be genetically male and have, you know, the genes to be male, but those genes don't get expressed and they appear to be female. And they will go through life until they try to reproduce, thinking that they're female. And likewise, the other way around. So, and there is, one out of 100 children born have some kind of what you might say is a gender anomaly.
Getting back to the idea of race, it seems that at that point when scientists started talking about race, it was, I guess, roughly around that time, when the one of the great enthusiasms in science was classifying things, mm-hmm. was taking whatever it was, rocks, plants, animals, whatever, and looking at collections of them and dividing them up into different sort of groups, depending upon some set of characteristics, you know, how many legs they had, or were they segmented, or
vertebrates, invertebrates?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, divide. There was this great enthusiasm for dividing up and classifying things. How is the notion of race? Is it really anything more than that? Is it anything more insidious than a natural extension of that idea that, well, we just want to classify and divide and organize and put things into categories and groups just as a way of understanding things better, how things relate to each other, and to impose some sort of organization mm-hmm. on this vast, wild collection of things that we see. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the impulse to classify has its, you know, historic moment, and scholars like Michel Foucault have actually talked about, yeah, it's kind of nice that people do that. And on the other hand, there is a discourse of power that goes along with it. I mean, because if you have the ability to classify, then you have the ability to assign place. And suddenly you get into a discussion about, okay, there's all these different kinds of human beings. Let's start classifying them. There's Caucasians, there's, you know, Negroid, there's Semites. And guess what? It turns out the Caucasian classification is a little bit better, or maybe a lot better, than the other one. So the ability to classify, I guess, hypothetically, as long as you didn't include morality in it or good or the notions of good or bad. But I think inherent in that notion of classification comes some kind of assignment of, good or bad. And the way that I think about that is that, you know, intimately connected to the development of race was the idea that some races had more diseases than others. I mean, I think the initial impulse to go to the idea of race was partly to look at humans as people had looked at animals, and if animals had, you know, animals had various kinds of animals within it, and then you could get into breeding, and you could breed superior stock. And from this very beginning of the idea of race went the idea that some races were kind of not as good as others, could be made better, and even the good ones could be made even better. So, which again is not an insidious idea. It's kind of a good idea. I mean, if you could breed, you know, if you had scrawny little goats and you can breed kind of like fatter goats, or cows apparently used to be the size of sheep or something, and you can make them bigger, then that was good. So why couldn't you do that with humans? And intimately connected with that was an examination of various human races and coming up with the idea that some were not as intelligent as others, some were not as healthy as others. So, for example, Jews in the 19th century, or Semites, were considered to be rife with all kinds of mental illnesses, physical illnesses, flat feet, you know, neurasthenia, whereas, you know, sort of the robust English peasant was seen as being sort of the height of kind of physical, if not mental, if not intellectual, you know, health. So the problem gets down to when you start kind of giving gold stars to certain, you know, certain races.
I expect that there must all along have been at least some people who questioned that very idea that intelligence was connected with race, or that morality was connected with race, or health was connected. I mean, that there must have been people who at some point said, "Now wait a minute, I've got a problem with this notion, and we really should be thinking about people essentially being the same on all levels." Was the idea much questioned?
You know, it's a good question, actually. You know, we'd like to think. I mean, this is one of the flaws of, you know, people have called in other forms like political correctness, the idea that if you look in the past, you're going to definitely find the people who kind of think like you now. Mm-hmm. And actually, I think that the people in the 19th century developed these ideas about race were actually, you know, progressive. In other words, you know, if you or I were living in the 19th century, there's a pretty good chance that we would be eugenicists. That is, people who thought that it was a good idea to breed the human race to be better. And because this was an era where they had, you know, the idea of progress was like the biggest thing there. Everyone was really excited about the idea that you could make progress. You could improve the human race. You could improve the economy. You could improve, you know, everything. And you could build bigger things, stronger things. Science and all, was, you know, leading the way. And so it wasn't that long a shot to say, well, why couldn't we do this with humans? And you actually don't find a whole lot of people, I mean, I'm sure there are some, who are saying, stop, don't do this, this is a bad idea, because it was in the air. It was kind of a, you know, the negatives of that conceptualization had not come around. And of course, you know, ultimately, even up until the Nazis, there were still progressives like, you know, Emma Goldman and George Bernard Shaw, Winston Churchill, who were eugenicists. It was really the Nazis who were the last people on the eugenics boat. You know, they were the sort of like, let's show the world that we're modern, who carried the idea of eugenics to its horrendous conclusion in the camps.
Yeah. Well, let's make a little bit of a leap here to where we are now, and where we've been maybe the last couple of decades, where there are more and more people who have questioned race, for example, who have said, well, they've gone as far as to say, we don't think that there is such a thing. There's the human race. There's all human beings. But that if you look at these ways in the past that we have broken people down according to their physical characteristics and assigned all sorts of things to them, talked about who they were and what they could be, or when we're doing that same thing with gender, people have said, all of these, we just made these things up. And then, lo and behold, along comes genetic science, and we take a look at, we come to understand DNA and take a look at it. And then the scientists who have done that have said, well, actually, as far as as race is concerned, that's right. You know, there's no, you can't look at somebody's DNA and identify their race from it. And that's where we get to this point where we say, yes, there are some differences, but they're hardly even worth talking about. There really is no difference. And I guess then, so the question is, as far as identity and what makes one person different from another, then where does that put us?
Well, you know, first of all, you have to understand that identity and race particularly are social categories. And so, I wouldn't poll your listeners, but I would suspect that a fair number of them would actually believe that there was a genetic test for someone's race. That's not an uncommon belief. When I talk to my students, you know, sort of a fair number believe that you can genetically find out what someone's race is. I think people believe that, you know, when you see a human being with dark skin, that there's a cluster of behaviors and abilities that go with that skin or with a hair quality. And, you know, from the point of view of your DNA doesn't sort of care about the concept of race because the idea of race is about 200 years old and DNA is a lot older than that. What DNA cares about is, you know, making proteins that will make physical characteristics that are different. So I guess what I would say is that the concept of race is still pretty prevalent, and even in a positive sense. I mean, I just spoke when I gave my talk yesterday. I was speaking with somebody who was Jewish and who said that, you know, he didn't want to give up the idea that there was something hereditary about being Jewish. You know, that was something that was good for him, and he liked the idea. I think there are a lot of people who would say, I am of a particular race, and I'm proud of it. And I think that's part of that's an end product of the identity politics that have been going on for the last, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. And so I think we want to be careful to say that there's the distinction between people's conceptualization of their own identity and then what's the biological, you know, reality, if there is one, that might be different. And, you know, the generally accepted point about DNA is that you know, most human beings are pretty much alike. Human beings are a fairly new animal on the planet. You know, we're about 100,000 years old. And that's nothing compared to look around and see all your other friends, the cockroach and the ladybug and the, you know, even your pets are probably older than humans are. So, you know, we do share, we're very much alike. We're a very homogeneous creature from the point of view of our DNA. And I think that's the big revelation of the Human Genome Project, is to say how similar we are and how genetic variation is actually between people who are called races is actually greater within smaller groups than it is between any individual and the larger group. That's a slightly difficult concept to manage, but you have to believe me on that one. And but this is something that we have been talking about, is that there is a new move on the part of geneticists who perhaps were uncomfortable with this sort of wishy-washy, we're all the same kind of thing, now to try to reinscribe race by focusing again on disease in the same way that in the beginning of the idea of race, where you associated race with various peoples who were seen as disease-ridden, let's say, or degenerate. Now there's an attempt to look at certain diseases that are apparently carried within certain groups, Tay-Sachs for Jews, sickle cell anemia for African Americans, and say that there's, you know, that there is indeed a genetic basis for saying that there is race.
I should introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Leonard Davis. He is on the faculty at University of Illinois at Chicago in the departments of English, of disability and human development, and also medical education, and has written on all of these areas about literature, about politics, about disability issues. He's here visiting the campus. We're talking a little bit about the idea of identity and what it is and how it is that people think of themselves and how it is we think about people being different from one another. Now, where do those characteristics come from? Are they physical? Are they social creations? And what does it mean that, for example, the genetic scientists tell us, well, everybody essentially is the same. And then they say, well, maybe not. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. You, in the talk that you gave, you seem to be, one of the things you seem to be saying is that for people who are in the humanities, people who are not scientists, and maybe particularly people who are interested in these various issues that we're talking about, it's probably a good idea to have at least some familiarity with what scientists are doing, because they continue to deal with some of these same issues. And here, sort of case in point, is that if all you heard was the headline that says, you know, DNA analysis says all human beings are alike. And we said, and then you went from that and said, well, I knew that. I told you so. Now we can sort of, you know, if people want to celebrate their race, ethnicity, their gender, fine, they can do that. But that's, you know, that's sort of up to them to do that. A lot of that stuff we're going to sweep aside. The fact is that genetic science is still looking at differences between people, and it shouldn't. You know, perhaps what you're saying is that it shouldn't be left to them to continue to do this kind of thing, because if they do, then, you know, the rest of us who are not scientists and who think about those issues in a different way might not be happy with what the result is.
Yeah, I have a pretty strong feeling about this, which is that, you know, back to the 19th century, there sort of was, you know, anybody living in the 18th century would have, you know, who was an educated person, would have been fairly familiar with both science and the humanities. And, you know, there was, in fact, the people who were the scientists were not scientists in that sense. The 19th century really saw a big division between science and the humanities, or science and the rest of the world, in effect. It's something that C.P. Snow called the two cultures, you know. And that split, I think, has had a huge, powerful effect on us, because, you know, I think most of us feel like the scientist in the white coat is like somebody, they're working on something, they know something. It's like we have nothing to tell them. I mean, we can't take our knowledges and bring it over and say to a scientist, you know, you should change the way you're thinking about this. And it's kind of almost like a shibboleth. You know, people really are not allowed to tell scientists. Whereas scientists or anybody else could tell anyone in literature, the humanities, so even the social sciences, what they should or shouldn't do. And people feel comfortable to opine. And I think that that's a very dangerous thing. And all of those, you know, sort of movies about mad scientists that came about in the 50s and even literature before is a kind of popular sort of unconscious revolt against the idea that you can't intervene with science. You know, if in some ways, if the development of the nuclear bomb and the hydrogen bomb had been a more public thing, there's a fairly good chance that maybe if a lot of people got to talk about it, it might not have happened. And I think that, of course, scientists, when they work on things that are, you know, uniquely something that only scientists can understand and talk about, I think that's fine. But when they work on something like race, race is a concept that we all own, or that we all have an opinion about. And, you know, somebody uses the term the public sphere to mean that area where people talk about things and discuss it. It's sort of like what NPR does, is very much part of the public sphere. And in the public sphere, I think we've come to the point where we feel like there can be no discussion. Part of it is our educational system. I mean, most people don't know anything about genetics. You know, most people don't even know the first thing about genetics. And if they do, they just have some vague image of that double helix floating through space with kind of magical music, spiritual music behind it. But it actually is not it's not difficult to understand to get the first basics about genetics. And if you do, you'll begin to see that the area that a lot of money is being spent on, a lot of work's being done, is actually kind of like a, you know, I say it's like the period during the robber barons, you know, when everybody's out there trying to make a buck and trying to figure out what this thing is. It's a very complicated field that scientists and geneticists who work in it are only beginning to scratch the surface and understand. And then this particular point that I'm making is that we have a stake in talking about, you know, should geneticists go ahead and work on connecting race up with disease? Do we want to have a situation where people groups of people will be assigned a kind of disease status. I mean, it's already, there was a front page story in the New York Times about how Jews carry 10 or 15 genetic diseases. Now, you could argue and say, well, that's just the fact. On the other hand, it's a little more subtle than that. I mean, I think that, you know, certain groups tend to get overstudied in science, and therefore they will, the focus will be on them, and diseases may be found, differences may be found. These are going to have huge consequences. And just think in terms of, you know, insurance. You know, if you have a group that's been overstudied and therefore a number of diseases have come up, and a group that's been understudied and or it's just seen as the general population, and when actuarial tables are drawn up, and you know, how do they handle the situation that a particular group might be seen as more diseased than another group? The other thing is also that the very basic way that people are going about, the scientists are going about talking about race, creates problems. I mean, I'll just give you one quick example. There's a huge project going on now called the HapMap, which is an attempt to map little snips of DNA that might be particular to particular human populations. And the first meeting that the HapMap group had was to decide, how do you go about dividing the world up? How do you go about gridding the world? And there's two ways you can do it. One way is this, I think it's called the Wilson method, which is that you just lay a grid over a country, let's say Africa, and then you, inside the each square, you pick one person. So it's completely random. You just find one person randomly inside each square, and then you take the DNA from that person. Now, people argued, they said, if you do that, you might find an Indian person who's just happened to be living in Africa, or you might find a white person, and then you're going to say that this is characteristic, the DNA is somehow characteristic, or they're all one group together. So then the other approach was to say, no, let's not do the Wilson method. Let's just pick black people, or people who report themselves as black, and then we'll take their DNA and we'll say that's characteristic of this area. And that very simple decision, you can see, is loaded with all kinds of very heavy preconceptions, which is going to then ultimately influence the way the HapMap is created, which is then going to say to us, oh, we have this group of people who have this characteristic. So this is where the general public needs to be discussing this and saying, we think it's better to use one method or another. And it's perfectly valid. I think a way I've explained it, anybody could understand the issues that go into it.
Well, I can, you know, going back to this issue of, you know, trying to look at people assign them to various categories when it comes to risk of disease, for example. And, you know, I can imagine that people in the medical community saying, well, you know, all we're trying to do is to be more effective in treating disease. And wouldn't it be a good thing if, for example, we could tell people that, you know, there's the possibility you're going to develop a certain disease, or is the possibility if you marry this other person over here and you have children, then the chances of them having these diseases are this, so you might want to think about that. Or even if we get to the point of saying, you know, you have somebody who comes in with a particular condition, say that they have heart disease, and you as a physician, you have 10 different medicines that you can give that person. Wouldn't it be good if you could look at them and then look at these 10 medicines, and rather than doing trial and error, because we know that some medicines will work in some people better than others, you could say, well, because of these characteristics that you, my patient, have, I know that drug number 6 on my list of 10 is likely to work better for you than any of the others. So why don't we go ahead and do that? Mm-hmm. I guess some people would say, well, gee, what's wrong with that?
Well, I think what's wrong with that is fairly simple. It's the question of if we know that within any particular racial group there's greater variation than within the whole human population at large, in a way, that's a question. Like if you pick a group like African Americans, there's going to be greater variation in African Americans in general than there will be if you think of all humans. Or, you know. So that's one problem. The second one is if you use race rather than some other criteria, you're going to end up reinforcing the idea that there is race. And the question is, do you want to do that? Because ultimately, the best way to do it would be to check you, for example, and check you for 25 markers. And if you have those 25 markers, then go ahead and treat you for, you know, any particular disease entity you might be carrying, rather than looking at you and saying, now, let's see, are you a black, are you a Jew, are you a, you know, an Asian? And then if you are, let's see whether your group carries that more or not. I mean, in a way, in the short run, it's been an economic thing. It's like saying it's easier to just sort of ask you to self-identify and then assume that if you're Jewish, let's test you for Tay-Sachs. But in the long run, we're ultimately going to come down to the idea that each human being has a specific genetic fingerprint, and we're going to want to find out what yours is, not because you're part of any specific group that you say you are and don't say you are. Then the other thing is, like, what do you do about people like Sally Hemings' descendants? You know, are they black? They may indeed have lots of Thomas Jefferson's DNA. So they may self-report being black, but in fact, lots of black people in the United States have white, you know, white forebears, and lots of white people have black forebears that, you know, I mean, we just don't know. You know, a lot of Jews have German, you know, forebears or Polish forebears. I mean, we know, you know, they're based on whatever sexual encounters happen that were recorded, not recorded, a part of being an oppressed people, etc. So the reality is that the neat category of race isn't really very neat, and in the long run is probably not a useful one. It's certainly not a scientific one.
We have a caller. We'd welcome others into the conversation. A caller here is in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Yes. Dr. Davis, I would like to turn to the question of consciousness rather than genetics. And since you raised the name of Emma Goldman, one of my heroes, I'm going to pose the question to you, and perhaps even to David as well, a favorite party question or social question that I like to ask my friends. Just who are your people? And I'll hang up and listen to the answers. Thank you.
I take the question to mean, okay, you're talking about identity. Does it mean something, how people think about who they are? I guess the question is, and you may or you choose or to answer or not, I guess that is, so how do you identify yourself? How do you think about your, me, Leonard Davis, how do you think about my identity?
Ah, I wasn't quite sure about the question. I mean, he said, how do you, something about choose your people. I wasn't sure he meant, like, your favorite people, like, he likes Emma Goldman, so, but anyway, I'm a little unclear about the question.
Okay, well, obviously, you and I think that it's two different questions. You can answer either one or neither. Neither. All right. Well, that's okay. All questions cannot be answered, particularly those that where we're not sure what the question is. The caller certainly may call back, and other people are invited to call as well. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm interested in hearing a little bit about some of your experiences, and I mentioned way back at the beginning of the program that you grew up as the hearing child of deaf parents, and you've written about that. You've written a memoir about that, and how, I guess what I would like to hear about is the idea of disability and how that enters into this conversation about identity. And
sure.
In fact, I think you think that the way that we think about disability, or perhaps the way that people with disability think about disability, offers some way of thinking about this whole mm-hmm. issue of
yeah.
identity.
Actually, disability figures in very prominently because the whole connection with race is that people who are racialized, to use that term, were considered people with disabilities. In other words, they were seen as chronically ill, even down to having higher incidence of deafness or blindness or being seen as, you know, unproductive in a larger sense. And I think that the distinction that people in disability studies make is between people who are impaired, that is to say they have an impairment, they can't walk, they can't do something, they have a physical limitation, and how they're disabled by the larger social forces that make environments that don't have ramps, that have conferences that where there isn't sign language interpretation, have televisions that don't have closed captioning, etc. And so the idea is that, you know, being disabled is kind of a social phenomenon. Impairment may be an individual's particular pluses or minuses physically. you know, growing up in a deaf family, I mean, I certainly saw that. You know, I had parents who were just, you know, very capable. My father was, you know, held an American record for walking 25 miles. He was a race walker. He was a great artist in his own right. And, you know, my parents were both very intelligent. And yet they were, they, you know, because of their deafness, they were put in a place at that time, you know, in the 20th century, later 20th century, they were factory workers. And, you know, they were oppressed because of their identity status. Yet within that group, they certainly, within their own group, they had a greater sense of their abilities, but they still internalized a lot of that outward, you know, pressure. And I grew up, you know, very aware of the fact that, you know, people would always stare at my parents on the subway in New York, you know, because they were using sign language, and that there was, my friends used to think that my parents were inferior in various ways. I mean, they would say things that would indicate that my parents were kind of brutish or animal-like or dumb in that original sense. So I definitely grew up with a sense of kind of injustice about that. And part of the work that I've done is to try to make understandable to myself as well as to other people what it means to have a disability, how that identity figures into your own sense of yourself and your place in the world.
Did you, growing up, feel as you were growing up that you were part of the deaf world or the deaf community because you had parents who were deaf but you were not deaf? So did you feel that you were part of that world or were not, or sort of in a sense had a foot in each? One?
Yeah, I think that I'm a CODA. That's the term, child of deaf adults, and there's a whole bunch of us. And we have conferences and things like that. But we all have this issue that we are part of the deaf culture and part of the deaf world and also part of the hearing world. We're bicultural, very much like someone who grows up in a family that speaks Spanish. So there is a sense in which you feel part of the deaf world, but then you're also kind of like the ugly duckling because you don't fit in. You have another world. And it is a very difficult position to hold because you're both, you feel both loyal and disloyal. You know, you feel like you are a part of something and at the same time not accepted fully into that world as well.
Earlier, you talked about the fact that there would have been a time when progressives would have been eugenicists. That is, that they would have embraced this idea that somehow we can improve the human race, and that if you can do that, why not do it? And that it was the Nazis that finally, ultimately brought that idea into disgrace. Now it seems that we've got to consider this again with what we're learning about genetics and our increasing ability to manipulate human genetic material so that we could, you know, theoretically get to a time when we understand, if we understood the genetic basis of disease well enough, we could think about possibly getting rid of some diseases. So that, for example, you know, if we can understand why people might be born without the ability to hear, we could fix that. And maybe we could get to the point where maybe there would be still people who would, through some accident or something that would happen in their life, they might lose their hearing. But maybe we get to a point where there were fewer deaf people. Or, you know, pick your disease, pick your condition. And then, of course, we get to the point where people start thinking about the fact that, well, okay, maybe you could do that. Then if you decide that you want to have a child, you can, and you've got the money, you can go in someplace and you can look at a checklist and you can say, well, let's see, I would like to have a girl, I like her to be blonde. I like her to have blue eyes. I like her to be tall, be an outstanding volleyball player so she can get a scholarship in college. But I think it'd also be nice if she was a concert violinist. And you know, the idea is that at some point we might actually be able to do that. So no more, when you have kids, no more roll of the dice. You can choose in all sorts of characters. So that gets us back once again to this idea of eugenics. I think that some people are saying, oh, well, we may never get that to that point. Or if we do, it's going to be a long time away. So we don't really have to worry. We don't have to worry about that now. And others saying, no. Now is the time to be talking about this before we get to the point where we can do it. And how well do you think we're doing at facing up to the idea that we're going to come back to this conversation again?
Well, again, I don't think we're doing such a good job. I mean, we're reading the newspaper stories, and the big story would be, should we clone, should we not clone? Right. And I think there's a general agreement, except for among certain, you know, egomaniacal individuals who want to clone, that cloning is not a good idea. But that's only the tip of the iceberg, as you point out. I mean, you know, the Gattaca scenario, you know, of designer babies is actually here. I mean, you know, we now, with in vitro fertilization, we now can come up with, say, a woman can have 10 possible eggs implanted and can be told that each one of these eggs has, you know, we can already do that. We can say this egg is going to be deaf, this egg is going to have cystic fibrosis, which one do you want? And so we can assume that most people who are consider themselves normal, and that's a whole other question, will choose a baby that's, you know, without genetic defects. So that reality is there. Some of the more complicated things like intelligence, the ability to play the violin, et cetera, we're, I think, beginning to understand that there is no one gene that will govern that, and it's going to be pretty hard to play around with that one. On the issue of gene therapy, so far gene therapy has been unbelievably unsuccessful. In fact, it's been stopped in the United States because any time that it has been done, there's been serious mortality issues. We might come back around again in the future, but it doesn't look very real right now. But we are doing it on the plant population, and we are, you know, creating all of these Frankenfoods, which is very scary because it's actually not regulated by the government at all. I mean, that's an area where we should be talking about this a lot more. We're changing the whole nature of the food chain, and the argument originally was that you know, you could just shoot one little gene in and it wouldn't change the rest of the plant genome. We've already found out that that's not the case, that there are alterations to the general plant populations, that their DNA wasn't just changed on one place, but it was changed in other places. That's a real wild card. I mean, again, this is what, you know, I'm saying, that people need to have what I'm calling a biocultural perspective, where you need to be able to combine their knowledges of, you know, the way you would talk comfortably about whether George Bush should be president or not, or whether you liked a movie or not. You should be able to talk comfortably about whether you think that these kinds of things should be done to the genomes of plants and humans and animals, because the consequences are profound. You know, if you don't like a movie, it's not going to change the world. But if you don't like the idea that you might be changing, you know, the structure of nature, then you need to put your two cents in, and not just sort of weird environmentalists, psychologists, and certainly not just scientists.
Mm-hmm. So do we, do you think that we get to a point where we're going to be arguing about the virtues of randomness and imperfection in human beings? Do you think we really get to that conversation where we go back to the point of the progressive eugenicists and say, no, well, wait a minute. I mean, if we can improve the race, let's do it. On the other hand, and will there be people who are saying, well, we're not so sure about that. Maybe perfection is not, if that was achievable, maybe that's not such a great goal.
Well, you know, again, the human race and nature and animal life has developed over, you know, millions and millions of years. There's a lot of trial and error involved in that, and we can say that there's a certain kind of wisdom that goes with that trial and error. Somebody just, you know, sits in their lab and decides they want to shoot a new gene into a human or a plant. That's not based on millions of years in trial and error. That's just a guess. And the problem is a risk one. Is that guess worth the attempt? What are the consequences, possible consequences? The claim is that we can control the very carefully the outcome, but in reality, I don't think we can. And so I think we all, yeah, I think that's something that we do need to talk about in terms of our vision for whether you stick with kind of what evolution's given you or you do the kind of high-tech thing to make improvements. You know, even the eugenicists had a very limited way of talking. I mean, not the Nazis, but the eugenicists in the 19th century did not advocate making people marry each other to create this. What they advocated was a kind of voluntarism. You know, they would try to get together what they called fitter families, you know, fit people, and ask and encourage them to mate with each other. So it was kind of self-evaluation, like, yeah, I'm fit, I'll marry a fit person, as opposed to getting rid of negative influences, which what the Nazis did. I mean, that was a whole new idea. But in a way, the Nazi plan of getting rid of the unfit was actually small potatoes compared to what we're talking about now. I mean, the consequences of, I mean, I'm not saying that there weren't horrible things in what the Nazis did, but it's actually, as a plan, as a general plan for how to alter the human race, much, or the environment, much smaller game than what we're talking about now in this very casual way.
Hmm. Well, we're at the point where we're going to have to conclude. For people who are interested in reading some of the work of our guest, Leonard Davis, maybe I just mentioned two titles again that you might want to look at. One, Bending Over Backwards, Dismodernism, Disability, and Other Difficult Positions, published by the New York University Press last year. Also, you might be interested in his memoir about being the hearing child of deaf parents. That's titled My Sense of Silence, Memoir of a Childhood with Deafness, published by the University of Illinois Press in 2000. Leonard Davis is a professor at University of Illinois Chicago in the departments of English, in disability, human development, and also medical education. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. It was fun.